Today, we're looking at the concept of learning spaces, their evolution, and the importance of designing environments that enhance student experiences. We have Associate Professor Dr. Ben Cleveland from the Melbourne School of Design at the University of Melbourne, Stefan Roddick, Secondary Vice Principal at Alice Smith, and Sean May, Head of School. They discuss the historical context of learning spaces, influential figures in the field, and the significance of stakeholder involvement in the redesign process. But let's not waste any more time. Come with me instead as we get into this episode.
Welcome to the Alice Smith Pod on Purpose podcast. Get ready to be inspired and informed as we uncover the stories of intentional impact and innovation.
It's great to be chatting with you both today, Ben and Sean, as we discuss the fascinating topic of learning spaces, the history of them, our current understanding, and the future of them. So my first question is over to you, Ben. What counts as a learning space, and why is it important to have this conversation right now?
Oh, yeah, thanks, Stefan. Look, I think it's a really important question when we're talking about schools, and one that perhaps isn't asked as much as it should be or as commonly as it should be. What are we talking about when we're talking about learning spaces? Well, I guess the overarching thing would be anywhere where learning is happening. You know, lots and lots of places are learning places or learning spaces. But I think probably our conversation is going to get a bit narrower than that. And we're talking about purposefully built buildings and landscapes that we find in schools is probably at the top of our conversation.
Yeah, thank you. And Sean, why do you think this topic is really important for us right now at the Alice Smith School?
I think it's totally crucial because you're really intentionally trying to design spaces to enhance student experience and for students to be themselves and for students to express themselves. And I was thinking, just driving to work this morning, you know, the way I arrange my workspace is quite particular and what I need around me so I can concentrate and get in flow. And students are the same. You know, when they get to know themselves as learners, they tend to arrange their spaces in ways that kind of suit them. So we've been thinking quite carefully with Ben and his team around, well, what are the optimal things, you know, depending on the age of a child that they like to do to engage in, to really accelerate learning, get in the flow, and also to be pro-social with each other and to learn all those crucial social and life skills for well-being. So for us in this crucial journey, we're very excited to have Ben and many other experts kind of supporting that. But the students absolutely are at the heart of everything we're discussing.
Yeah, from my perspective as a teacher, I couldn't agree more. When you first go into teaching, you think it's maybe about the curriculum, and you can easily forget about the surroundings and their environment, which accelerates that learning development and all that for the child. So I think it's a really important topic that we're discussing today.
I love that point, Steph, because I'm just thinking about the learning spaces enhancing the curriculum and kind of giving children different opportunities in curriculum and also in how they learn.
Yeah, I think it's easy to think of the learning spaces in terms of early years, but then later on when we think of the secondary school, it's harder to envisage a school where learning spaces do take on a dominant role in that developmental process.
Although I would add, Stefan, too, that, you know, perhaps that's because, you know, the sort of expectations that we might have of, say, secondary schools, that we have, you know, different expectations of primary schools, and you sort of all wonder, what, how have we gotten to those situations, you know? Sean started talking about the students rearranging their spaces to suit their needs, but how often does that really happen?
Yeah.
You know, and I think they're sort of really important questions to ask and not to assume that, you know, schools are a certain way, but to really interrogate that.
And I think that leads me on to the next question actually really well. So what has been the history of learning spaces in schools, and how has research contributed to those changes over time?
Well, one of the things that's quite an interesting exercise to do is sort of look at the history of, you know, how schools have been designed, say, over the last 200 years. And, you know, since, you know, compulsory education's been a thing, obviously before that, you know, schools weren't sort of ubiquitous in the way that they are now. Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of changes. And, you know, even the advent of the classrooms, you know, only about 150 years old as a place for learning. Learning happened in all sorts of other contexts in you know, years before that. And I mean, certainly research has contributed to that, but also, you know, not everything's fed by research. It's what's happening in a particular context in a particular country has also led to developments. And people have looked across the world and borrowed ideas, you know, from one place and supplanted them and put them in other places as well. But, you know, I guess more, you know, as sort of the academic knowledge has developed over more recent years, certainly research has had a much more significant impact on the way we're thinking about space in schools, and we're trying to, I guess, fine-tune and elaborate on some of the things that have come before.
And I'm just wondering, just to pick your brain a little bit with this, what is the main difference that we see now between a school that was built maybe 150 years ago and a school that is being built today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious one is that, you know, schools built 150 years ago were pretty much exclusively, you know, built around the concept of the classroom and the corridor as a place to get from one classroom to another, you know, and rarely did learning happen beyond the four walls. But, you know, now we're seeing, you know, as Sian's sort of alluding to, you know, much greater sort of variety of different types of spaces in schools, because we're recognising that students need access to what I would call a whole range of different affordances, that is, places that offer different action possibilities. And so, you know, the curriculum's had a big impact on that. You know, the curriculum sort of dictates the kind of activities that you'd like to see happening, and you need spaces that will afford those things.
Yeah. And in, I suppose another question I've got on the top of this is the world is developing at such a rapid pace right now. Within 150 years from now, what might be the things that we might expect within a learning environment?
Well, I mean, obviously the integration of technology is never expanding exercise. So 150 years, I don't dare to guess really, but you know, we're seeing, you know, sort of AI assisted technologies having a, you know, sudden impact on our classrooms in the way that we weren't talking about even a couple of years ago. So it's hard to tell, but I still think there's, you know, sort of fundamental human, you know, comfort needs and just human requirements that, you know, we're still physical beings. And so we're still going to require environments that are comfortable, that are conducive to social interaction, that will allow us to use the technologies that will become, you know, part of the teaching and learning exercise. And so I think, you know, maybe the buildings won't change as much as we might expect, but the technology will certainly change a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Just one final question to you, Ben, if that's okay. Who are really like the notable people that have changed what we see as learning spaces?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really interesting question. If we're talking about people who've had a research influence, the first person that probably comes to mind is an American fellow named Henry Senoff. He did a whole lot of work in this field in the late 70s and the early 80s, and is still around and still working well into retirement, I believe. I'd also suggest that my academic mentor, Ken Fisher, has had a really significant role and actually worked on the Alice Smith master plan of about 25 years ago. So there's a really strong connection between us all through Ken. Yeah, I mean, those sorts of people have led the way. Another significant person over recent years has been a British fellow named Peter Barrett, who did a really wonderful project named Clever Classrooms, which had a really significant influence in the UK and just sort of brought to the attention the importance of really thinking carefully around all sorts of factors when we're talking about, you know, the quality of classroom environments and other spaces in schools.
Thank you. Sian, would you be able to elaborate on a lady named Mary Featherston for us, please, and tell us about her influence on learning spaces?
It's quite an interesting one because she doesn't come from the field in the same way that Ben does. So there's not the layer of science behind it, perhaps, or the craft of different things when they're more in the academic zone. But it was a privilege to meet Mary Featherston on one of our school visits in Melbourne. And what really struck with me was actually she's a furniture designer primarily, and actually everything she was looking at was design principles. So every other area of human life has actually been designed and redesigned, you know, 100 times over. And her belief when she started to look at classrooms was actually they could do with a bit more of a refresh to be a bit more pro-human, a bit more pro-social. And we had a very interesting conversation, a bit like Ben just said, that we're both physical beings, we're psychologically complex beings, we're emotional beings. So what should space look like for children to really be themselves? And Mary was tasked with looking at a school and following what the children did in primary and kind of having a look all day, a bit like the footfall study you might do in the use of a building, like where do people sit, where do they stand, where do they lean? And she came up with a particular design of a classroom area, and it gave children access to all the things they tended to do that were preferred activities that supported their learning. And actually, for me, it doesn't mean Mary's truth is the one truth, but it's a good provocation to all of us when we're studying what young people need. You know, how does the environment speak to the child? How does it tell the child that they're capable, that we believe in them, that we believe they have potential? And that we don't, I suppose, conform them to their age group, that we always allow possibility for the ceiling to be lifted. And that kind of really stuck with me. So anyone who's listened to me since I came back from that trip will have heard the Mary Featherston story. And I suppose it makes me think about design in all of areas of our life. And, you know, increased sales of the Kindle mean that people still love reading and they don't necessarily want to read on their iPhone. It gives me a bit of hope that if we keep the human at the center of things, we won't go far wrong in kind of raising the next generations.
I think it's a really good point that stakeholders can be from a range of diverse backgrounds as well. So Ben, how do various stakeholders for you play a part in the process of reimagining learning spaces in schools?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'm really very, very interested in. And well, one of the things I think if you take the position that, you know, that our buildings and our landscaped environments in schools are participants in what we do, they're not containers for our activity, you soon come to a realization that when we're thinking about redesigning school facilities, well, we're actually, the exercise is actually redesigning a system, not just a thing. And so stakeholder involvement is really important. So everyone who's associated with that system needs to be involved. So we've got obviously heads of school, we've got other school leaders, we've got staff in terms of teaching, especially student involvement's obviously key because they're the main users, the main occupants of these facilities. You've got other people like, you know, who's in charge of school administration and maintenance. And so all of those people who might be associated with a system that runs around that building or that landscape really needs to have a say, because we're actually, in most instances, we're asking them to think about, you know, alternative, potentially improved futures. And so they need to be involved in those conversations and have their contributions heard. And contribute to a sort of development of what I would call a shared understanding of where we're taking this system and what role the building plays needs to sort of fall out of those conversations.
It almost takes a community to build a building.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things, you know, that is the building the project or is it actually the ongoing inhabitation? And for me, it's the ongoing.
And Sean, what has the stakeholder involvement looked like with Alice Smith?
It's actually been quite wonderful. So what Ben has just described, I would say in layman's terms, is the listening phase. And Ben, alongside many others, listened to our children of all ages, many of our parents and many of our teams, so professional services and our educators. And actually, I think there were some extraordinary moments in those sessions where people provided just the most unique insights into who we are as a community because of our spaces and where we want to go. And I think people felt listened to, validated, encouraged, incorporated. So I think the process is invaluable. What we've been able to do then is work with our Council of Governors and have a look about how do we make this a reality? Like, what does that look like for the next 10 to 15 years if we're to realise all these dreams that we want for our children and our community? So it's been tremendously energising and exciting so far.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure to be involved too. You know, and to me, you described it as the listening phase, Sian, and I think often when we're talking about school buildings, you know, there's not enough listening. Often architects will say, we'd love to listen more, but we're not given the chance. You know, so I think, you know, Alice Smith was a great example of, you know, if you can organise and mobilise the people who should be doing the talking and you've got the design team there listening, that's often, you know, leads to really wonderful outcomes in terms of the building project. But then it's over to you guys for the future of how you're going to inhabit some of your new facilities in the future.
And I must say, being part of that process myself, it's quite exciting to imagine what could be in the next few years as a member of staff, but also as a member of the community. But I was hoping that you might be able to name drop a little bit now, Ben. So where might we find excellent examples of where learning spaces have been a key focus and learning has been positively impacted?
I'll have to be a bit Australian-centric, I think, in my responses to this, because obviously that's where I live and that's where I do most of my work and most of my research occurs here too. I think over the last few years, one of the projects that I've really had a sort of great affinity for and really enjoyed being involved in was an unusual state school project here in the state of Victoria for a facility in a school that's called the Centre for Higher Education Studies. And so this was a very unusual one-off entity. It's a school for really, really high achieving students who are in our public education system that is, you know, funded by the state. And it was a project that there was no model. And so we had the opportunity to do lots of listening and to listen to all sorts of people who might have a contribution to such a model. And, you know, in terms of the building, we've produced a space which has a great sort of degree of flexibility in how you might use it. but also, I guess, an inherent sense that student agency and the capacity to work with other high-achieving students needs to be the thing that's most enabled. And I think we've been able to do that. You know, it's been operating for a couple of years now, and lots of people have come to see it, and I've been on many tours with the principal. And he talks really glowingly about how it's working and how it's being able to accommodate things that they hadn't anticipated doing. And so to me, that's a success.
Thank you. Sean, what impacts do you believe are possible at our school, the Alice Smith School, through reimagining our learning spaces?
I think for me, it's just a massive opportunity to have a multiplier effect. And I think if you think of the excitement coming back this summer to some of the ways in which learning spaces have already been redesigned and communal spaces have been redesigned, the way it gave energy and hope and kind of a different way of relating to one another that was really evident this term. When you map that into 10 to 12 years of meaningful work and you think about the year 5 to 6 project that is absolutely on the agenda of council, and you think about the creativity hub at secondary campus, and you even envisage those and all the interim projects that are cited, like the Wellbeing Centre for Children here at secondary, that's extraordinary in its impacts. Because the minute you place a wellbeing centre at the heart of the school, you tell the students about destigmatisation, being proud to be themselves, that being well mentally is just as important as your physical and academic results. I think it's a multiplier, and I think everyone subjectively will enjoy it, be energized by it in a different way. So for me, the future looks extremely bright, and we're very fortunate to be talking about these great things, to be able to leverage them for our children and our community.
Really couldn't agree more. And kind of this brings us on to the last part of our conversation, where we're going to look at the takeaways. So Ben, what do you feel are the key takeaways from this particular discussion that you would like listeners to remember?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have an appreciation for learning spaces, but usually it's not, it's not an overt conversation that we're having about them. We sort of have a sort of like a precognitive reaction. We might like or dislike a space, but we're not really having an active conversation about it. And I think what I'd encourage people to do is actually have those active conversations. Say, well, how is this space working for me? How is it not? How is it maybe working for others or maybe not? And I think, you know, not always do we have the chance to redesign a building, but we can curate the interiors. And doing that in conversation with those others around you, doing that in conversation with students especially, because, you know, they're the ones who are really going to benefit or not, I think can really, you know, bring ideas. It can provide a context for talking about education in a way that perhaps doesn't get talked about enough, and that space can really enable and constrain lots of wonderful things. And, you know, to sort of share in that conversation about how are our spaces working for us, how can we make them work harder, and how could we make them places that we spend more time and enjoy, I think would be the thing that I'd like people to do.
Thank you. And what do you feel are your takeaways, Sean?
Really straightforward. I've got some words that are going to linger long in my brain that Ben said earlier, which is, you know, you have the privilege of doing these great projects, but actually when you start to inhabit those spaces, the job of the school then is to think about how those learning spaces are used and what pedagogies, what learning experiences do our children take, and continuing that conversation about meaningful educational experiences with the whole community. I think for me, that's really clear that the gauntlet is laid down and the baton is passed, and we have to, as school leaders, take that very seriously. And it's a very exciting challenge ahead.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective too, my main takeaway is it is a real community venture, and that you all enter in this together. But I tend to get excited as well about the what could be from this, and starting to imagine how my own classes might change or other people's classes might change, how the school might look in a few years, the different feel that we're going to have. But thank you to you both. It's been a pleasure having this conversation.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks, Stefan. It's been fantastic.
And a quick message for you, the listener. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast channel. We've got some awesome content coming out in the future, and you wouldn't want to miss it. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.